Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega. And we're going to round out the hour by talking about a movie that echoes many of the conversations we're having about the racial justice uprising here in the United States. Spike Lee's The Five Bloods follows a group of Black Vietnam War veterans who return to present-day Vietnam to find the body of their squad leader, Stormin' Norm, who died in combat. Through archival clips and flashbacks, the film highlights the complicated position that many Black soldiers found themselves in during the Vietnam War, fighting for a cause that they didn't necessarily believe in, on the side of a country that back home didn't respect them. Returning to Vietnam brings back some uncomfortable memories for all of the characters, particularly Paul, who's played by Delroy Lindo.
I see ghosts, y'all. I see ghosts.
What happens to all of us, man?
Have you seen them too?
Yeah.
Dad come to you at night. Stormin' Norm comes to me down there every night. Now he talked to you like he talked to me.
Come on.
I don't think so.
I spoke with Delroy about the film as well as how he's engaging with today's racial justice movement. And he started off by telling me what he thinks the Vietnam War meant to Black soldiers who were fighting for the United States.
I think for some, it represented an opportunity to demonstrate their love for the country. That's one thing. And I say that up front because I think that that can sometimes get lost. And for me, it contributes to the tragedy of Vietnam and what happened, what ended up happening in Vietnam, because Black people love this country. And that sometimes gets lost in the various other dynamics that tend to overshadow that. But to your question, I think that for some soldiers, it was an opportunity to demonstrate their love. For others who were drafted, like my cousin, for instance, my cousin was drafted at 19 years old. And inside of 4 or 5 days of landing in Vietnam, he was in country fighting on the front lines. I think for young men such as that, it had to be terrifying. And I think perhaps a schizoid experience. And what I mean by that is that they're thrust into the middle of this violence, but have to, you know, to use a contemporary phrase, man up, right? They have to do the job that they are there to do. But I'm clear, there was profound fear, terror, that these young men were battling. And I think that that terror resulted in a lot of the self-medicating that went on and the gross difficulties that beset these young men when they came home, if they were fortunate enough to come home.
I think we often forget that the Vietnam War, many of the young soldiers that were sent there were drafted. They did not necessarily enlist to go. And I recall, you know, I was born in the 70s, and I recall seeing the Black and brown men in my community who, as you mentioned, came back and were beset with, particularly with issues of addiction. So it was a complicated legacy for Black and brown soldiers. Your character, however, in this film, his name is Paul. He's a vet. And it appears that the way that, you know, years and years after the war, this character has become a Trump supporter. And I'm just wondering, I mean, when we talk about art imitating life, we don't see a lot of Black Trump supporters. So tell me a little bit about that decision. And how did you feel about that?
Well, it was Spike's decision. Spike, and I guess Kevin Wilmot, the co-writers of this, I had trepidation. I did not want to do that. And I tried to talk Spike out of having my character be a Trump supporter. I would have been in favor of, and I said to Spike, I articulated to Spike, could we make Paul even an arch conservative without specifically being a Trumpite? Spike ultimately, he thought about it for a few days, but ultimately reached back out to me and said he needed Paul to be a Trumpite. So at that point, I read the script 2 more times. I asked Spike to give me some extra time, which he did. I read the script two more times, and a couple of things happened. I was able to rationalize Paul's decision, rationalize and empathize with his decision, even though it's not a decision I myself would ever make. They say never, but that's a pretty good bet. I would never, ever have cast that vote. For Paul, once I understood and started to work on this, create a biography for Paul, for myself, and I understood the depth of the loss and the betrayal that Paul has suffered in his life, not least of which, the gross betrayal for Paul coming back to America after volunteering. Paul was not drafted. I volunteered for three tours. Coming home after that third tour and being reviled and being called a baby killer, etc., which comports with the experience of many vets coming home from Vietnam. Once I understood that and had a grasp of that, I was able to empathize, frankly, the loss and the betrayal that this man has suffered, and led me to understand why in 2015, when this individual comes along who says, you know, I can make it better for you, I can turn the country around in such a way that it will be specifically beneficial to you and people like you, the disenfranchised, the disconnected, which is what Paul is. He's disconnected and deeply disenfranchised. Okay, so the anger, yes, that's true, but the anger is a resultant. The anger, and look, far be it from me to, I would never, ever want to dictate to an audience how they should respond to a piece of work. What I can tell you from being inside the work is that the anger is a result, the emotional state of various states, plural, that we see Paul exhibiting are resultants of the, frankly, pathology that has beset this man as a result of an inability to come to terms with these various experiences, these various losses, these various betrayals, not the least of which is the loss of my wife in childbirth, the loss of my son, quote unquote, in terms of the fractiousness of our relationship. And there are all of these elements of betrayal and loss that Paul has not been able to come to terms with. Therefore, these various pathologies are roiling around inside of this man's organism, and he has not been able to come to terms with them. Therefore, the impact on his emotional, psychological, psychic self, it's like a virus running amok, no pun intended, right? It's like a virus running amok. And frankly, I ultimately came to understand, or feel rather, that casting that vote in 2016 is also an outgrowth of that virus.
I want to use that as an opportunity to sort of pivot to where we are today in this country, because this conversation is happening at a moment that we almost can't, we can't ignore the context of the moment that we're living in. And I wonder, you know, this film is almost, the timing almost couldn't be better for this film to come out. And, you know, we're speaking at a moment when people are demonstrating against racial injustice in essentially a nationwide uprising, at the likes of which we have not seen, at least in my lifetime. And part of the conversation that's happening right now is involving Black actors and Black entertainers. And a couple of weeks ago, Star Wars actor John Boyega appeared at a Black Lives Matter protest in London. And he said, you know, look, I'm worried if I will even have a career after speaking out against this.
Yes. We are, and I want to 1 second to speak about people of color, and then I will broaden it. Because as we see, the rejection of status quo, the rejection of this violence and this pathology, this pathological status quo is, as we see, broad-based. It's diverse, and that's a wonderful thing. But for 1 second, I want to speak specifically about people of color. We are embattled we are being violated in ways that are frankly very difficult for one to get one's head around. And what I mean by that, I was looking last night at the murder of Brooks in Atlanta. That this should come, that murder should occur in this context, 3 weeks after the murder of George Floyd. And I thought, I've been thinking about this, speaks to the depth of the lack of acknowledgement and caring for our humanity by law enforcement. Now, that's an elementary and probably obvious thing for me to say, but what it is indicative of further for me has to do with law enforcement, the culture of law enforcement having such a, and this is a very broad statement I'm making, and we understand that there are law enforcement officers who do not necessarily fit into this category. However, there is a deep-seated component in law enforcement culture that sees us, people of color, as the enemy. Therefore, there is an almost constant sense of being embattled. The flip side of being embattled is that they apparently, even in the context of a murder of George Floyd that has become a national and international phenomenon, apparently it is still okay to chase that man down and shoot him in the back. One would think in logical, and I understand that life is not logical, but one would think that in some kind of a logical environment, he might pause and say, wait a minute, I might want to do this, but I shouldn't do this right now. And he didn't. And that for me is indicative of this deep seated, for want of a better term, ethos that sees black and brown people as the enemy. It is exhausting. It is psychically wearing. And as the parent of a soon to be 19-year-old African-American man child, I don't want to say it's confounding because I can't afford to be confounded. But it is a challenge and a phenomenon that I face, that we all face, that one on some level is not sure what the answers are. It's really important for me right now, Tanzina, not to come across as somebody who, when I say I'm confounded, which I am, that's not mutually exclusive to being proactive in whatever ways that I can, because that is our job right now. That's our job. No matter how this violence is landing on us, and the fear that we have for each other, for our young men, for my son, every time he walks out the door, one in the final analysis has to find a way of being proactive.
You gave us a lot there, because I wanted to ask you about this moment, about being a black actor in particular. And I'm just curious in terms of where we see activism, art, and black artists going in political movements like today's.
My response is to do what may be considered quote unquote small things in my particular sphere of influence. So what the quote unquote activism involves for me, or has involved thus far, has involved quote unquote small things, such as, since our humanity is being reviled and rejected, in this instance by law enforcement, I find myself doing things that enhance and affirm my humanity in my relationship to my fellow human beings. Volunteering at a food pantry, donating money wherever money may be needed. My son, who is 18, about to be 19, attempting, and it is not easy because he's 18 years old, attempting to give him context for this violence that is being visited on us. And what I mean by that has to do with not only how he should comport himself, but striking a balancing act between communicating with him the realities of this violence and what the genesis of that violence is, while at the same time not scaring or terrifying him, so that he can walk out the door every day and live his life as fully as possible. I've done PSAs. I speak to what art means, the critical importance of art in a time such as this, in which we are all deeply embattled. The kinds of conversations and actions that my friends and I are undertaking, all of these actions start with conversing. To be completely frank, all right, those things that I enumerated, the volunteering at the food pantry, giving money, donating money, they're really important to me because they are examples of my sharing my humanity with my fellow human beings in constructive ways. Two close friends of my son a few weeks ago organized a rally and a march, and this was in the wake of George Floyd's murder. I helped minuscule, tiny. It was their rally, it was their demonstration, and they were extraordinary. It was very peaceful. But the fact that it was organized by youth, these two kids, young men, are 19 years old, friends of my son that we've known since middle school. There were some instances in the organization of that rally in March in which I could help. And I really need to stress, and I did help, but I really need to stress that it was tiny. But in helping, in inserting myself into the preparations for that rally that these kids were undertaking, was yet another example of my asserting and affirming my humanity. And so the activism for me has manifested in those kinds of quote unquote small ways, but are critically important to me and affirm not only my humanity, but all of our humanity. And I'm doing these things, frankly, not as a quasi celebrity actor, but first and foremost as a human being and a parent. And if the fact that I am an actor and my presence in a given situation raises the profile or causes people to pay perhaps a little bit more attention, God bless it, and so be it. That's wonderful. But I would say to you, I am reacting to this turmoil as a father to an 18-year-old son. Lastly, I would say, having said all of that, I feel that I cannot afford, as none of us can afford, to be, I'll put another way, I have to maintain some sense of optimism, even in the face of this, of being and feeling embattled as I do. I have to maintain some sense of optimism for the future of the human race and the fact that young people are spearheading so much of the rejection of status quo, and that rejection and that spearheading has evolved into such a broad-based and diverse group domestically and internationally, must give me some sense of optimism, even though I am not naive about the world that we live in.
Delroy Lindo is one of the stars of Defy Bloods. Thanks so much, Delroy.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.